Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I've been traipsing down memory lane recently, for some reason, kind of reflecting on my experience as a wee lad, and growing up in the early 1980s, Southern California, in the dregs of the spiritual counterculture, and had lots of very interesting experiences as a high schooler. Very lucky to have stumbled into all sorts of odd meditation practices, weird sex, wandering Christian mendicants, Grateful Dead shows, UFO freaks, hippies, etc., etc. Really got me going for the topics that have taken up my interest in my life. And one of the things that I was thinking about the other day, I'd forgotten, was I remember coming across or being handed, sort of surreptitiously, a mimeographed Book of Shadows. And in the early 1980s, there was not a huge market for books on witchcraft, though they existed and had existed, you know, a fair amount since the late 1960s, and there's been dribs and drabs before then. But many witchcraft groups, people descending from Gerald Gardner and his Wicca, and then other offshoots and parallel developments, were interested in these books of shadows, and these were books that were used either by individual practitioners or of covens, where they would keep their various spells, practices, rituals. And I remember the extraordinary sense of, well, there's no other word for it, magic, that I felt when I came across this mimeographed, spiral-bound notebook and began poring over the information contained therein. Fortunately, I no longer possess this object, so I can't, you know, now with my sort of more scholarly understanding of these religious currents at that era, I would probably be able to peg its origins and influences reasonably well. But as it is, I just have my kind of storied memory. And really what struck me at the time was the power of the archetype or the figure of the witch. At that time in history, there was this interesting kind of inversion going on where in the 1960s, you know, 99 out of 100 Americans would associate the witch with something pretty nasty, at least the people who weren't fans of Bell, Book, and Candle. But, you know, the good witch or the sort of charming witch, despite having her, you know, avatars pop up in, you know, alongside Judy Garland and the Munchkins, most people had a pretty negative sense of what the witch was, and that part of the 60s countercultural rebellion was a sort of re-embrace of the, challenging and politically barbed aspect of the witch archive. There was a sort of powerful group of feminist activists, early feminist activists, who called themselves witch, and they were very much trying to sort of épater les bourgeois. And then throughout the 70s and 80s, there was this sort of transformation as the witch became this kind of multivalent figure, positive, giving, loving, earthy, and still edgy, disturbing, potentially revolutionary. And that tradition has continued, and now our own Maja Dawu here at Expanding Mind is contributed her own bit of media to that with a new DVD with the excellent title, How to Be a Witch. And so today we're just going to talk to Maja about witchery and her work and what she's trying to do with her new product in the marketplace of ideas and practices and gods and all that trippy stuff. And so with no further ado, let's bring on Majido. Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going good. That was such a great introduction. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, I do feel very much the same as you in that respect, that there is a kind of stigmata on witchery and witchcraft, and that its power as a taboo thing certainly is strong and remains strong today in our culture and society, even though, like you said, we've had lots of progress. The 60s and 70s saw more acceptance of the healing aspect of it after really just hundreds of years of disinformation, as is usually the case. So a big inspiration for my DVD was just to try to educate people about what exactly it is and what you can do with it and just how fun and amazing and wonderful it is, you know, instead of everyone thinking it's all, evil and satanic.
Well, one of the things that I like about your use of the term, that you embrace the term witch, is that, you know, a lot of contemporary practitioners of paganism who are working in the vein of witchcraft will refer to themselves as Wiccans, or they'll talk about Wicca. And that's cool. You know, that's a term that evolved as people wanted to take control of their own religious identity and their own practices. And, you know, many people felt that, many women in particular felt that the witch had a bit too much maybe Hollywood in it, a little too much Halloween, a little too much derogatory associations, and so they wanted a kind of, you know, a bit nobler term. And so this term Wicca emerges, which has its own origins, but was certainly a modern kind of invention for this current of the rediscovery of or recreation of pagan ways, although, you know, it's not entirely recreation because there are these matrilineal lines and there are, you know, bubbling practices that have been more or less continuously transformed. So you don't want to overemphasize the amount to which it's reconstruction, but a lot of it is. And I thought that totally makes sense to me. I think it's great. But I also sometimes miss precisely the sort of you know, kind of unnerving, but also familiar, but also sort of childhood-oriented, but still sort of disturbing associations with the word witch. And
well,
I'm curious.
It's really important, though, dude. Like, because listen, God bless Wicca and everyone who's Wiccan. You know, whatever, do whatever you like. But I do feel like sometimes people who follow some Wiccan practices can leave out some of the shadow stuff. And like you said at the beginning, the book that you so relished that introduced you to this work is called The Book of Shadows. And a big part of the whole situation that is magic, or even many aspects of religion, is that, you know, we're here on the earth, so we have to include, like, the nature and our physical bodies, right? And, you know, the root chakra and all those shadow stuff that you maybe won't even get introduced to if you go to a lot of churches, right?
Well, let me ask you a question. So, like, right there, you were kind of making an association between shadows and the earth and the body and the root chakra. But I think some people who would, let's say, are on the, you know, maybe the sort of the very self-consciously positive expression of a Wiccan revival would say, hey, don't confuse those things. You know, there's a difference between the shadow side and, you know, the body that's healed and the nature that we can, you know, reconnect with. For you, when you think about the shadow side and that element that you want to see as part of, you know, witchcraft or part of pagan practice, what are those things for you? What is that extra element that takes it away from just sort of a romantic view, let's say, of nature and the body?
That's a really good question, Eric, and I think a lot of people don't ever think about that or make the distinction. I feel like a lot of people that point out that there's, you know, the spirit world and then our physical world, and they do not want to bridge that gap, you know, rainbow bridge or no, they choose to separate those two things. For me personally, I feel like our access to the shadow realms is through the root chakra, through our animal soul, through that, you know, dirt, mud, earth part of us is how we get in there. So I feel like for people that say, you know, don't mess them up, they're two distinct things. Well, I first of all would disagree with that. They're a part of the reality that we're experiencing now. We just can't perceive it until we go down into the dungeons, until we go into our shadow worlds. And for most of us, that's the fear spot, right? So that's the root. That's our kind of physical existence, the life and death place. So that's why I make the affiliation with the two. And I think some people think you can just, you know, focus on God and light and then get right into this stuff. But if you don't have that root, you know, I feel like that's what kind of messes people up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I was thinking about this question in another context. This week I went to see a screening of Rock Razam's Eye Awakening. So we spoke with Rock about 6 weeks ago about his really wonderful documentary. And I got to see it again on the big screen, and it has really good digital effects, and it's a first person rather than a kind of traditional talking heads documentary. He's really trying to kind of capture the feel of his own personal experiences in the jungle. So the evening was interesting. We had a panel discussion, and there were a lot of enthusiastic people in the audience who were interested in ayahuasca, and some of them, you know, not so experienced or not experienced at all, and some people who were old hands at Santo Daime, et cetera, et cetera. And a friend of mine commented later that he thought it was very interesting, but that there sort of was this unspoken model of what was happening with the entrance of ayahuasca into the West, which was this sort of unquestionably positive evolutionary thing, like we were moving towards some kind of great transformation. And he was saying, you know, it's not really, in a way, what the medicines or even the medicine work is about. And when you make these connections with these powerful forces, powerful, you know, earth energies, that there's a lot of darkness and trickiness there. And he felt that people were being sort of overly religious about it in a kind of traditional way. And what really struck with me, and I want to hear you riff on this, is that even in so-called, you know, alternative or countercultural or progressive zones of spirituality, that even though people are often consciously trying to do something other than Christianity, other than mainstream Western religion, is that it's very easy for people to kind of reproduce the same thing, so that ayahuasca becomes the mother who's giving and loving, and the whole side of the brujos, the whole side of the tricksy realm that is opened up that you need to know about if you're not going to get consumed by this stuff, if you're going to go into it. That gets kind of washed away because it doesn't really fit, because we don't have a language of balancing dark and light from, you know, the traditional Christian religion. So that must be an influence. Yeah. You know, so I'm sure that's part of what you're thinking about with all this stuff.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. Because, like you said, this is the thing. People will, like, maybe have an experience or a group experience or a history, and they'll think, like, they know the thing, right? This is the way. This is how it goes. And, you know, it's that the old Taoist thing. I swear the Taoists are witches. If I ever met any witches, Taoists are totally witchy, right? Because it's that resolution of black and white together. And it is. You can't set or fix anything, okay? So anytime you make a religion or a counter-religion or an alternative thing to a religion, then you're still, like, setting it apart as something, and then you're still separating and you're not unifying. So I do feel deeply that it's so difficult to try to organize and set any kind of group like that around ideals and not make it rigid. And
right.
I feel like the whole power of the witch or magician or whatever you want to call it is that you cannot become fixed on what you think the thing is. You absolutely understand that that's not possible and it doesn't follow the laws of nature, you know?
Yes, that's very interesting. That that willingness to not know all the way through. And I think that was what my friend was talking about too, was there was just such a desire to feel like you know what's going down. When it seems
yeah.
to me that a lot of these, a lot of the practices that can support one and open up different domains of the self, of reality, of different, you know, planes, if you will, that they support precisely to the degree to which you can let go of having an idea of what it is exactly that you're doing.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? And it's a very interesting thing. Listen, before we talk about the DVD and what you're doing on it, I just wanted to get a little bit of stories from you, from your, you know, younger years. When
yeah.
did you first kind of stumble across this idea of the witch and start to think of it as something that you would identify with? I mean, what were the experiences you were having? Were books, nature, people in your life? I mean, I know this has been a part of your life, you know, in some sense forever, but I'm curious as you grew up, like how this sort of, just even the word and the associations with it became a site for your own spiritual group development.
Yeah, totally. I love your Book of Shadows story. That's like the cutest intro to witchcraft. It's a kid story ever. I really was lucky to come in to my mother because she had a good setup for me upon arrival. She had my mom's a Scorpio, and, you know, I was conceived in the Himalayan mountains themselves. She was there in Tibet doing all kinds of hippie stuff, you know. So she was into the concept of magic and witchery, and she had tons of books. There was books about every kind of religion you can imagine, and she was always encouraging my sisters and I to be, you know, imaginative and inventive and creative, and we'd always be outside playing. I grew up on a little island in the Northwest called Vashon, and it's a total hippie island, so I was again in that environment and then spent the majority of my time in the forest. There's just, you know, the Pacific Northwest forests was pretty much where I spent my growing up time. And then my first intro to really like witches and that particular formation of it was around when I was, you know, like 13, 14 years old. I was totally the stereotypical teen witch story. It is funny. Like, I think almost every teenage girl gets, like, a little witch thing. What do you think? Have you found that to be true, Eric?
Certainly a lot. A lot that I knew. I mean, I was the first people who, like, you know, would talk about the Ouija board and things like that were girls, you know?
It's
so there
weird.
Seems
I mean,
to be
it's
some...
always like, I know, it's literally like when we get our first period, all of a sudden we're witches or something. I don't know. Like,
you know, just to interrupt, you know, this reminds me of one very interesting, widely acknowledged, let's not call it a fact, let's call it a sort of aspect of the paranormal, is that poltergeist phenomena are widely associated with, you know, adolescent girls, with the turn
yeah.
to puberty, that there's something right. about that space that is associated with these peculiar kinds of demonstrations, if you will. And it seems like it would certainly be related to, you know, an attraction or an interest in witchery. And certainly we've seen the figure of the teen witch just, you know, explode over the last couple decades, and now it's just kind of installed in the teen, you know, sort of imaginary universe.
Dude, that's such a good and astute and true observation. I feel like, you know, when, I mean, I'm not going to get into like some, you know, period talk, like half the audience is going to be like, oh God, it's going to be that kind of witch show, but there is significant changes that happen to a little girl in puberty. And I had all kinds of weird supernatural stuff happening. So for me, I was like trying to find out what was going on. So, I mean, I think what you said was true. Like, I think ladies just start having weird stuff happen around that time, and then they try to get answers or investigate or talk to other girls and be like, dude, that was totally freaky. Did that happen to you? You know? So then people form covens because they're trying to figure out, like, what is happening. And there is a unique experience, I think, in being a lady because you get to have that happen through your physical body. Like, it becomes, you know, the alchemical transformation story becomes our life story in these like weird meat suit experiences that we have to endure as ladies, which of course, you know, men have their own that they have to go through too, but there is something a little more supernatural about the whole like birth and death thing that goes on with us. Yeah,
that makes sense. I mean, at no point when you're a male, even though there's all sorts of obsession with death and with you know, violent games, even little boys will do this stuff or whatever. There's not really, like, you never get to go through a sort of marker, a period
right.
where suddenly you change and the world that you're, and the kind of being that you're changing into is more directly linked with sex and death. So, I mean, that just, you know, must be a remarkable thing for women to go through. But, I know that you've also, you know, a lot of your own journey has been very singular. You know, your own unique blaze through possibility. But have there been periods of your life, maybe recently, maybe earlier, where you were sort of tapping into this witchy energy very much in the as part of a collective with other women or other people? And has that been part of your experience as well, or have you tended to be more a solo practitioner?
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, I absolutely do both. I'm really hermity and value and cherish my time alone and will do things like take trips by myself to the mountains. So I maintain a very strong, singular practice where it's only me. But then at the same time, I pretty consistently, from the time I was a teenager, have been involved in communal activities as well. And I value so much all of the opportunities and the instances I've had to work with others in this stuff. So I feel like I get to personal breakthroughs and experiences on my own that are so valuable and sacred, but then it's so amazing. I mean, you know, anything that you've been a part of on a group level, whether it was a really good concert or like, you know, some kind of political movement where you get to experience that feeling of the, you know, connection of humanity. It's just really profound, and it's one of my favorite things about doing magic with communities.
Were there people or communities or even individuals that you came across when you were younger, personally, who really opened you up, where you had some kind of maybe a mentor or an inspiring collective that kind of helped you, you know, develop your courage or confidence in your
I absolutely
practice?
Did, dude. And my original coven, my OG coven from back in the day, was the debate team, the high school debate team. Was my coven. They were all skateboarders, and we were all like kind of, you know, skaters and into counterculture and everything, and of course, like consuming drugs and all, you know, drugs or whatever you want to call them. So that was like, it was this core group of individuals that I was able to experience a shared consciousness with, and we would take trips all over the country, because we were really good. We would win like all the debate tournaments. We would just kill it, man, because we were arguing on, you know, on higher levels that the majority of folks on high school debate teams just had not gotten access to these kind of ways of magical thinking and consciousness breaking. And there was my two mentors were these two guys that were just these notorious skateboarder trickster guys known on the island. And they were amazing. One of them went on to go to Oxford and worked with like J.R.R. Tolkien's stuff, and the other one is like a really famous computer programmer. They were just these like intensely smart dudes, and they disseminated things like Murray Bookchin to us, Noam Chomsky. They had us reading Starhawk. They just would like fill us with these books about these alternative ways of thinking. And so my initiation was literally on the debate team in this really isolated, amazing environment.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. It conjures up so much. I hope you can write that someday if you ever do your memoirs or write a story about, based on your experiences growing up. Because even, you know, as I age and move through different things and come through new insights and on often somewhat disenchanting insights about the experiences or ideas I had when I was younger about spirituality or politics or, you know, what does it mean to be in the world, that I nonetheless find myself always returning to paying attention to those initial encounters and downloads and inspirations and conversations. There's something about what happens, even if what your understanding and what you think you're understanding in retrospect you can see is a bit naive, you're sort of young, you're blah, blah, blah. Nonetheless, there's a kind of purity or a kind of strangeness to those inspirations that that I think are very valuable to keep a hold of, because they often come from sort of strange angles. You know, I think people sometimes feel like they're gonna, you know, it's gonna be really clear that this person is a spiritual mentor or something, when actually those guys
can, right, I know,
they,
it's funny,
they come
huh?
from all over the place, and maybe it's just one conversation, and maybe it's someone and you have an amazing conversation, and the next time it doesn't really make any sense, and it's just that one connection. But those, that's where a lot of the jewels lie, at least for me.
Yeah, me too. You know, I've never, certainly have great experiences at religious facilities or events or stuff like that, but I have to agree with you. Most of the time, it's just when I'm openly connecting with another person or group of people that it becomes like the largest moments of spiritual teaching for me.
Well, that's one of the things that's interesting to me about your work. I mean, you know, people listen to this who don't live in Los Angeles. I mean, you give regular public talks, and you've been doing that for years and years and years, and you have, you know, your fans and more casual listeners. And, you know, you do events, and you know, now you're producing this DVD, you've written books. But there's a quality, particularly when you're giving talks, that I really admire, in that you're sort of, part of you is like a spiritual teacher, and people will sort of appreciate you that way or approach you that way. They're kind of, you know, they're kind of enamored with your work. But then you're also really kind of both goofy and nerdy in a way that undercuts the typical sort of pattern of like the earnest, deep teacher and the sort of foolish, learning, you know, seeker type. And so you're kind of like, I mean, you always remind me kind of like those people that you have conversations with in a more random way that nonetheless prove to be really significant. How much of that is just the way you are versus like actually being kind of conscious of not going down some very tried and true and frankly tedious ways of, you know, providing spiritual guidance or information in today's world?
You know, it's so important, and I've experienced so many trials and tribulations along those roads. But I would have to say, you know, yes, a little bit of both of those. You know, it is actually how I am, but I'm also conscious of not engaging with people on a guru or hierarchical level. And there's many people who project that onto me and request it and would like it, which to me I just see as, you know, a lovely inspiration that something I said to them was good. But for me as an individual, I'm just like, I still have people say so much awesome stuff to me that why would I like limit anybody by making me be some end-all be-all thing that they're going to listen to? Because for me personally, I want to listen to everybody. I would never, even though there are gurus that I enjoy, right, I'm going to read like 20 or 30 different ones. I'm going to read the Bible. I'm going to read the Quran. I'm going to look at Buddha. I'm going to look at anybody. So whenever anyone wants to kind of like just focus on, you know, an embodiment of anything, they're taking it away from themselves. And that bums me out, because a big part of my MO in my nerdiness and openness to people is that I truly and legitimately want everyone to experience this. I mean, that's why I talk about witchcraft and magic, because I want people to learn it and do it themselves. Like, don't just look at me doing magic. Like, I want everybody to do it. I want to have, like, armies of generals instead of armies of soldiers. So I think the whole idea of, like, yes, we can have teachers and influences, but I have those too. So, you know, I want to share my teachers with you too, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, this is great. We'll have lots more to talk about in the second half of the program. We're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dayu talking about witchcraft, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and today just having a conversation with co-host Maja Dayu about her new DVD, How to Be a Witch, talking about witchcraft. And so when you decided to make this particular DVD, you know, you talk about a lot of stuff. You talk about shamanism, you talk about healing, you talk about Chinese medicine, talk about astrology. You know, you really got your fingers in a lot of esoteric pies. Why was it this material that you wanted to bring into and share in a DVD form?
Yeah, there's infinite amounts of interesting stuff in the esoteric world, as you just mentioned. Like, there's so many different ones. And the reason, specifically, I wanted to present the witch material is because I do feel very strongly that the witch material is at the base of all those other things, right? I think if you can learn those basic things about how to obtain knowledge and wisdom, right? Because I define the word witch from its etymology as one who knows. It's very similar to shaman, which means wise one, and Wicca and Wiccan comes from wise, or like being able to have knowledge. So there's many practices that the witchcraft has set up so that we can get access to higher knowledge. So I feel like no matter what other esoteric path you're going to take, or occult path, or what your interests are, if you can have that foundation of knowing how to get up into the higher realms of your mind, it'll only make all of those things better, and you'll understand them a lot easier and be able to do more. So I kind of view it as the building block.
So what are the core practices, and where did they derive from? How did you come up with them or discover them?
Yeah, they're really told in every single religion. The way that I have kind of whittled them down is through accessing, you know, many different religions and looking at the commonalities and saying, well, what is it that all these people are doing in order to achieve these higher states of mind, right? What is it? So you look at everything and you say, well, okay, there's all these things that people are doing. What is the basis of all of those things, right? So you try and whittle it down. And then a big influence on me was my teacher, Dr. Calvin DeWolf, who did a lot of whittling and really was able to bring it down to a point of a very simple system. So essentially, for me, the main things that you have to do in order to be a witch is you absolutely have to meditate. There's no getting out of it. Like, there, a lot of people think, you know, to be a witch, you got to go buy a lot of candles, but most, you really need very few supplies. So you totally have to learn how to meditate. You have to do discipline to control your will, right? And again, those two things are part of almost every religion as well, right? You have to have, the discipline is so that you have self-control, because once you start going into these places, you know, like you said, where a lot of people say the shadows are, you're going to need to just know and understand that you can do what you need to do and not be all scared, right? So then you also have to be able to hold that discipline over time, and that's with the actual magical practices, like a ritual or a spell. So it's about, can you hold some energy that you've started, right? And that's, again, if you look at a lot of religions, it's like, well, you can make a prayer one day, but then can you live it, right? It's the walking your talk part. And that's, to me, what all the rituals and practices really aim at, making some physical manifestation of all these ideas that your higher mind is thinking. And that
Here's a question for you, just to jump in, because it's something I often wrestle with. I've done a lot of Zen practice, and so I've come to have a certain idea of, you know, when I'm working with powerful energies or insights or intuitions, that even as I acknowledge them and allow them to change me or to invite me in more deeply, that I have an equally powerful tendency to want to let them go. Not to push them away or bury them, but to let them go in the sense of not necessarily kind of holding on to that mode or that particular state of consciousness or that sort of insight or identification, you know, because it seems to me one of the problems people get into is they, you know, there's always this danger of ego and ego inflation, and you have a new experience and then you identify with it and you get a concept around it and you hold on to it. And I've seen that mess up a lot of people. But at the same time, I sometimes go, you know, there's a certain way in which having this kind of intention and this focus and having an idea of a particular state or a particular perception and holding on to it and working with it over time and really, you know, hold, you know, in some sense, keeping the engagement going or keeping the portal open. And I find myself kind of often moving between these things. And I'm curious to hear you talk about how you make that kind of discernment between something where you're just kind of identity, you know, anybody can be, I'm a meditator, I meditate every day, I'm disciplined about it, 5 to 6 a.m. or whatever it is, and you're like, dude, you're just like, watch, you know, you're just like being a sport, whatever, you're, that's not the thing. So I'm curious how you have come to that.
Yeah, it's, you know, what you just described is the dilemma of Shiva and Shakti, right? Shiva is the destroyer that eliminates every thought as he thinks it. He doesn't hold on. He lets everything go, right? That's the fountainhead or the unicorn horn, which is what allows our prescience, right? We have to continue destroying and letting go of every thought as we have it. But then Shakti is the one that holds and remembers every thought ever sunk and every thought possible to think, right? It's that amalgamous goo that just kind of contains all of it forever. If Shiva ever once thought it, then it remains in that sticky, gooey Shakti, right? So how do you kind of work with oscillating between those two things? I feel like, you know, we can again use the Vedic way to describe it. If you are always Shiva the destroyer, right, you're always forgetting everything and just forging ahead, that's the Icarus myth, where you get too close to the sun and then you just kind of poop out. But if you have these periodic returns to those memories or sticky ones that you just can't let go of, that's what they call, right, the eternal return, where we have to, like, keep going with the forgetting, but then also, like, remember ourselves periodically so that we don't get too far away from, you know, where we came from.
Yeah, I love that your use of the term remember. That's one that's really been coming around for me lately, and it was brought up a few times at the IO Awakenings panel as well, because it's got all these wonderful little nuances to it. I mean, there's just the encouragement to remember, for, in my case, let's say, from my own experiences. Like, I often, in my sort of tendency to let things go, I often forget about a lot of remarkable events, synchronicities, intuitions, insights, conversations, encounters. And so part of what I'm realizing is, like, just the act of remembering, in the simple sense of the term, is a way of sort of weaving that web of balancing, in your terms, the Shiva and the Shakti. But it's also, it's got this really wonderful, you know, imaginal shamanic element of this notion that if part of growth is breaking yourself down, is being broken down, is unweaving, unraveling, shattering sometimes, that the action of remembering oneself, of putting oneself back together, is not just something that happens naturally, but it's something that we're called upon to do as well. And that's where discipline comes in. That's where physical work comes in. That's where meditation work comes in. That's where psychological processing comes in, is that we're part of the way in which we build that body after being shattered, that new body.
You just said that so good. I'm really glad this is being recorded. No, that was it right there. It's the work, right? That's the craft. It's the great art. It's the magnum opus, that work of putting ourselves back together after being shattered. That's the process of, you know, why we practice witchcraft. It's for that exact reason. It's those origins go all the way back to Egyptian magic with the Osiris and Isis, right? Take it apart, put it back together. It's all the same concept, what you just said right there.
So when you, you know, you mentioned before, like, it's not so much about, you know, black candles and this doodad and, you know, this particular practice. There's this question of ritual and what is the essential elements of ritual. And I'm sure that's something that you've dealt with. I know it's stuff you've talked about before. So when you're talking to people and you're saying, look, you know, part of this is on you to cultivate different states of mind, cultivate your body, and open up to the energy and different ideas, what for you are the kind of core elements of ritual, particularly things that people aren't thinking about? You know, sometimes it seems like people are actually closer or already living in that element of ritual, of blessing, and not just being aware of it. So part of the trick is to just, like, reframe what people in some sense are already doing. But how do you approach that issue of encouraging people to develop that practice from the kind of the baseline?
Yeah, it's really important, because I think a lot of people, you know, like you said earlier, they just start concentrating on the thing and they forget what the thing was about, you know, that whole thing. People, like, put so much in the ritual and forget what the purpose of it is and lose sight of that in the actual, like, action that they're doing. And there is, you need to kind of, with ritual, it should be like a little thought out, right? Because I think the purpose of any spell or ritual or meditation should ultimately be concentration of the consciousness, right? So if I'm going to make a ritual, the first thing I tell people, if you want to do a ritual, you practice it. Ritual means repeat or retell, or, like, literally renumber or kind of count, right? So it's like counting. So it's like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And it has this idea of a repeated, rehearsed thing. For the soul, you gotta, like, focus on the thing and repeat it and rehearse it and get it right. But then I look at it like playing music, where you practice it over and over and over, so that in the moment when you are doing the ritual, it has to be spontaneous and kind of, like, you know, in that moment and improv, so that you can absolutely let go of the attachment to the thing you're doing. So
But it's an improv on top of training, and that's really, really key. I remember we had a conversation on the show a number of years ago with Jeremy Glick, who's a ceremonial magician, and he's, you know, studied you know, psychology at Stanford. I mean, he's a totally brilliant, you know, left brain thinker as well. And I remember, you know, asking him about, like, what was the sort of key element in developing his sort of magical side of him. And I thought he would come up with some, you know, elaborate, complicated, Kabbalistic, you know, intellectual journey through all of these systems. And his answer was just, well, you know, it's funny. It took me a while to realize that it was really just a matter of practice, that it was, that the most important element was repetition and return and training of the body, of the mind, of the breathing, imagination, and that this work, you know, it bears fruit, and it bears fruit precisely in allowing that kind of more intuitive, more improvisatory, less structured experience of things, but that it rests on top of a lot of structure and a lot of training.
It really does, and it's no different. The practice of the craft, the practice of magic, is like the practice of medicine or the practice of music, for that very reason that you just said. Like, you have to, sure, someone can, like, sit down and sing a song, like any yahoo can do that, but if you want it to, like, to be an expression of your soul, you're going to have to maybe sang a song a couple of times before, you know, and maybe like been able to access that part. Because if you never get to the point of access through repetition, you can't just like make it go all of a sudden. I mean, unless there's literally some miracle involved or love, that'll do it too.
Well, here's another question, you know, again, brought up as I was thinking about the kind of ayahuasca scene and frankly thinking about some of the ways that I think people are cavalier and can be can even endanger themselves depending on their own psychological sensitivity or their own issues and traumas, that, you know, as people plunge into this work and begin to have unusual experiences, you know, there's all sorts of problems that can arise. One of them we've already mentioned, which is the kind of ego inflation. You identify with it. You think that now you've turned some corner and you're a magical person, and all sorts of difficult things happen from that. But there are other things that happen as well. What are some of the pieces of advice that you give people to, you know, keep on their toes and keep that discernment honed as they go down these, you know, sometimes very ambiguous, surprising roads?
Yeah, I think really the best advice is to share it with friends and, like, do stuff with other people, you know? I think people get too closed off and serious about this stuff as they go through, you know, any kind of spiritual awakening or initiation that could maybe have, you know, severe crisis or be terrifying and crazy and nuts. Like, you know, magic is nutso. You know, so the best way to manage all this stuff is, you gotta talk to your friends, be like, hey, like, am I cool? Like, what do you think about this? Like, you gotta check in with people, you know? And maybe not everyone will understand what you're talking about, but if you can communicate these things that you've experienced in such a way that's just open and honest, I mean, chances are most people have, you know, some experiences of this kind of stuff. So to keep yourself in check, to prevent yourself from, you know, getting deluded or having psychological issues, I always recommend just interact with other people, man, even if you just got to go in a chat room or something, you know?
So I'm curious, since you do, you know, give public presentations and you do have these people come to you, how do you deal with the sort of projections that come flying your way? You know, that's, you know, in a way, you've set yourself up in a interesting place to, you know, you're standing in the position of a teacher. You're trying to deflect and to encourage people to claim their own power and discover these things for themselves. But at the same time, you know, you're putting out a DVD. You're calling yourself a witch. You have a, you know, a sort of magnetic personality, and it comes through in your public appearances. So, you know, you're obviously going to get stuff coming your way. How do you deal with that? Do you just accept it as part of the, you know, the price of business, or you know, how does that become almost like a practice that you have to take up in order to manage that energy?
It totally has become an important part of my practice of everything else, like being able to deal with the energies of other people that approach me is literally a necessary component of my work. I know you know that to be true, just even as a public presenter or talker.
Oh,
you're
absolutely.
Immediately just, you know, it doesn't even matter if you're opening up to maybe more than five people that you don't know. Now you're in that situation where there is not an element of defense, because that's not how I see it. I don't view when people come up and attack me like I have to defend myself. I don't fall for that. No way. Instead, I believe and trust in what I'm doing and why I'm there, and I don't take flack. I mean, I don't want to say like I'm not open to criticism or, you know, people who don't agree, because I absolutely invite that. But one of the things that I feel like I have been able to develop is, you know, I'll get hit with all kinds of reactions from people. Some people will attack me, like even in the magic school I've had people do that, where they just speak out and say something nasty or whatever. Or whether it's people that send me emails, or maybe people at the events that will have an immediately adverse reaction, just even to the word witch. Like, it doesn't even matter who I am or what I look like. They'll have some response inside of them to the word witch. So it's not that I'm being flippant or disregarding them, but I absolutely do not accept inappropriate behavior towards me. And I just have a pretty big boundary up, and I just shut it down. I mean, I don't know if that's the best response, but if someone comes at me in a threatening manner, I just disengage.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
You know? I mean just... what do you do? Have you been confronted with that?
Yeah, I've gotten some weird stuff, over the years. I mean, in a lot of ways, I've developed my own speaking and writing, you know, in relationship to the same problem where I have no interest in being a spiritual teacher, although I'm very interested in illuminating and being parts of people's own development and their own questioning and their own process of inquiry. And I have found that, you know, at certain gatherings, especially where I'll present, you know, then I know it's coming, you know, and then I'll get this stream of, you know, in my experience, often sort of, you know, somewhat unusually minded young men, usually who are kind of a little confused, but also really brilliant. And it's clear that there's not a lot of people who can just understand them. And that's what I found is that people are drawn to me because I have been, you know, I have this capacity to really listen and really, which a lot of people don't do, and really kind of get where very unusual people are coming from. Like, I can sit down with some pretty unusual people, and I can kind of get where they're coming from, and they can sense that.
Totally.
So they're super psyched, but then they want to, you know, share everything with me. And if I don't keep my hand on the tap, I burn out. I just lose all my energy, and then I'm not good for anything. So I've become very aware. It's mostly energetic for me. It's not so much about where they're coming from, like some kind of psychological jujitsu. It's more like I just constantly check in with my dantian, you know, with my lower belly, and be like, how you doing down there? Oh yeah, we got some juice up here. Okay, let's keep it going. And then at some point it's like, man, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna walk away, I'm gonna go sit in my room by myself, I'm gonna go get a tea, you know. So for me it's a very energetic process of checking in with my body and my emotions and just like how it's up for it. But it's a tricky one, because that's also why I'm there. Like I feel like when I do that stuff, like, yeah, maybe the talk was cool, maybe it's online, whatever, meet some famous guy, cool. But it's really those encounters, particularly people who need to be heard or to be recognized or to have a conversation. That's where I actually feel, that's why I'm really here. So I take it very seriously, but I also really watch myself.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I think that can be helpful for anybody who has to appear in public, from musicians to speakers to, I mean, you name it, because it's true. But your strategy of the Dantian check-in is pretty good. I like that a lot.
Yeah. So, that's great. So we're just got a couple of minutes here. Are you doing events around this? Are you, is the DVD available? What's the story that you can tell folks about?
Oh yeah, sure. The DVD is available on my website. If you just go to the web store, it's there under How to Be a Witch. My website is godismyboyfriend.com. So you can just order it on there, and it will be on Amazon shortly as well. And I did an event at the Steve Allen Theater, which is run by my friend Amit Eidelman. They do the Trepanny House stuff there, which they have an amazing schedule on there this year. If you guys like to go see Smarty Pants talk, that's a good time to do it. And I'll be doing a few other events, probably surrounding the material on and off, which I'll put on my Facebook page for folks, and also updates on my website.
So we just got a couple of minutes here. When you do these events, I'm curious, what's your attitude towards the limitations and the possibilities of public ritual, and, you know, in the sense that you're there and you don't know who's coming, and, you know, you're on stage and let's play with the situation. How do you approach that particular, conundrum?
Yeah, I try to just really be open. When I'm there doing the ritual, I try not to judge if there's any, you know, grumpy pants or people that aren't into it or whatever. I don't care. I'm there to perform the ritual. And every time I've done it, there's enough people that are, you know, happy and into it, and the energy is high, so it's not an issue. So, because I guess to answer your question, because I've had so many good and positive and amazing experiences with the group ritual, I just kind of go into stuff, even though I don't know who's going to be there. If there's, like, you know, one friendly face, I'm good. Like, I'm there to do this for them. So I just kind of focus on that.
Yeah, that's a handy thing. That's something I wish I could do more sometimes when I give talks. I can tell that there's a big chunk of people who aren't into it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's not that it gets me upset or that sometimes I lose my flow because I really love that feeling when it's kind of engaging that way.
Totally. It is. It's a lot about flow.
And then what about your sort of next project along these lines? Is this going to spin off into some kind of series or what else do you have in the pike?
Yeah, I'm totally making another one right now on angel magic, and it's going to be focused on not just angels like in a Judeo-Christian sort of way, but it's going to look at like the magic of the others, or like the whole idea of this, you know, other higher source or other being or demon or angel or alien or whatever you want to call it. It's going to talk about like what are these kinds of magic that other beings bring down, and what are they saying to do? So I'm going to
Great.
Try and,
well, I totally, we didn't even talk about that today. It's a fascinating topic, and I look forward to doing that when that one comes out. So thanks a lot, and good luck, Maja.
Thanks, Eric. That was fun.
All right. Well, from me and Maja to all you out there, keep your minds open.